Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you live with portions on recording. You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning with us, author of Enigmatic Pilot, Chris Sanders. Stay tuned. Me and Sarah Jane by Genesis. And thank you, Jim Cardilla, for that. And then there was another person on Facebook as well for the recommendation of that tune. The reason for that being, sadly, here's fanboy talking, the death of Elizabeth Sladen. Ah, there's a name that may not be a household word. At least not in this country. In England, she probably, you know, is a household word most literally. But for those of us who are Doctor Who fans, and remember, by the way, that the new season of Doctor Who, the 32nd season of Doctor Who, starts this coming Sunday, by the way, set in the United States, at least the first two episodes. It's a, cliffhanger episode, as Doctor Who always used to be. It's a two-hour episode. In my first Doctor, the best Doctor, which is the best Doctor ever? It's your first Doctor, okay? The first time you saw Doctor Who, whoever the first Doctor was, that was the best Doctor. For me, it was Tom Baker. When Doctor Who first came to the United States, and you saw sort of this Harpo Marx-like, friendly, benign character with this long, long scarf whose only implement outside of his time travel machine looking like a 1960s police call box was an electronic, a sonic screwdriver, and aided and abetted by a woman who had met up with the third Doctor. The Doctors sort of get killed and then they regenerate in a secular fashion. And the fourth Doctor with inherited the companion of the third Doctor. And that companion was Sarah Jane Smith. No relation to Sydney Smith. But Sarah Jane Smith. And she was played by Elizabeth Sladen. And she was sort of like unceremoniously dropped off by the Doctor at one point in the series, and as happens with companions, never looked back upon again until about 3 years ago. A writer by the name of Toby Whithouse, just before he created a TV series called Being Human, he wrote an episode called School Reunion, in which the Doctor, now David Tennant, the 10th Doctor, goes to a school, and there is Sarah Jane Smith, who as a reporter is working on the same story. And the Doctor is now not only united with a companion, but has done what they could never do in earlier versions of Doctor Who, is smitten with Billy Piper. And Billy Piper meets Sarah Jane Smith. And it's like, you know, the X in the current.
Nice.
It was a, as they will say, brilliant episode. It was wonderfully written, wonderfully done. And it brought Elizabeth Sladen, Sarah Jane Smith, back into the eyes of the public to the point where they created the Sarah Jane Adventures, which had finished four seasons. And I've got to say, Sarah Jane Adventures, watching the Sarah Jane Adventures was watching old Doctor Who. It had the types of scripts of Doctor Who that they had in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the early, before it got slick. And it really was a throwback, and at least two Doctors, both David Tennant and Matt Smith, made appearances on the Sarah Jane Adventures, and they were going into the fifth season of the Sarah Jane Adventures, some of which, so there was one episode in the fourth season with just some brilliant Sarah Jane's wedding day. And at the very end of the first episode, of the first of two, on the cliffhanger episode, as the priest is saying, if anybody, you know, has a reason to not let these two be married. And just as those words are being spoken, you hear the iconic sound of the TARDIS appearing and the Doctor tumbles out. I mean, it was wonderful. It's a show for little kids. I don't care. And here's the point. The 63-year-old woman starring in an action adventure that was good for the kiddies, thereby setting a role model, and fun for the adults, being, you know, fanboys and fangirls, of which I would include, you know, myself in the fanish category, doing a wonderful show. And yesterday she died. And of cancer, apparently. I don't know all the details. This Saturday's premiere of Doctor Who will be dedicated to her. And I'm sad. She was a part of my second or third or fourth childhood. I'm about my 19th right now. So, okay, had to take that time aside. I have no announcements about readings this week because, well, you just missed one. At the KGB bar with the wonderful Kit Reed and the enigmatic pilot himself, Chris Sacknessum.
Well, thank you very much. It was a fun read. I hope there were lots of people there. So if you weren't there, I'm sorry about that. But there were many that were, and it was a really good, fun time.
And while I was not there, resting up after two days of Passover and listeners last week doing a three-hour show last week, again, it must be said again, thank you, Robert Knight, for giving us that time. And bleep you, whoever the powers that be, if anybody can be blamed for the fact that there is no archive on WBAI servers of last week's show. If you, listening last week, have an air check of last week's show, please write me, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, or Jim Freund, FREUND, WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. So I got on that. Oh, yes. So I wasn't there at the reading tonight. Gordon Linsner, once again, you know, stood in for me. Instead of my trusty little Zoom H4, he had a trusty Sony recorder, which are still good, the analog tape machines.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Believe in the analog.
Yeah. So I will be hearing the performance and possibly in the future even broadcasting it.
Oh, that'd be cool. Yeah. It was fun. It was a nice night.
But it's good to have you here live again.
Very pleased to be here, Jim. It's always fun. I don't know what it is. It's not just New York. It's just a good feeling. I got it last night flying into JFK. You know, you can have a terrible time with that. And it just was so easy and just felt like, oh, you know, back again. And no, it was great to read tonight and to see a lot of good friends. And I actually caught up with some people I haven't seen in about 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very good.
That's a long time.
Good. Yeah, because you were last year, what about, you read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings under 2 years ago.
Yeah. About 18 months ago, 2009. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would have.
Yeah.
That's what I would have said.
For Private Midnight.
Yes, from Private Midnight, your second novel.
Yes.
And recording, there was a recording tie-in for that.
Yeah, and I've taken that concept a step further with the next book called Reverend America, which comes out in February, and some really, really good musicians. Not that there weren't good musicians on the Private Midnight CD. But we've just ratcheted it up, you know, about three notches. And I think it'll be really interesting because it will be produced as a standalone CD to go with the soft cover version of the book. But in an electronic format, it will be integrated into the text.
Ah, okay.
So we're talking about
Are you doing only a Kindle version or iPad version? Are you going to have the rest of us?
No, we're going to have a range of applications there because there are differences, of course. So we're going to tailor that.
Yeah, as long as you got something for, you know, the rest of us.
Now, yeah, that's been taken on, point taken there. I mean, I think that's right, but
I'm into the non-proprietary world of this stuff.
Yes, well, you can't blame someone for wanting to play all the angles. You know?
Oh, no, you need to play all the angles because the business is in the proprietary world.
Yeah, and it's changing so fast. We don't really know where it's going.
Well, we don't, yeah. I mean, by the time that book comes out, a year ago, Apple was the dominant phone.
Exactly.
Today it is not. So excuse me, the dominant smartphone. Actually, no, that's not even true. BlackBerry was and still is But people never count that. They always say Android versus Apple, and they forget quietly sitting at the top, possibly losing ground.
I hope so. I'm not a fan of that particular brand.
Of the BlackBerry?
No.
Yeah. Well, no. You see, if you're a texter, that's the best phone. If what you do is mostly email and texting to people, that's the one with the most readily available, most usable keyboard. If, however, you're looking for video and maps and all kinds of applications,
simplicity,
it's one of the others.
Yeah.
Actually, the BlackBerries, you know, I'm not a BlackBerry person, but they're pretty simple. If for the application. Mm. Remember, the application of the BlackBerry is email and texting. Everything else is, you know, bonuses for them. They invented the concept of the smartphone. They pioneered it. And it's all about email. And texting is almost an extra, and everything else is an extra. So if email is all that you need to do, the BlackBerry does it, is the simplest. Because you take it out, and there's your email, and you can write the response, and you put it away. You don't try to find a map. You don't try to do this. You don't try to do that. That's the, you know, if you want to use applications aplenty that are constantly changing, constantly being innovated, you do the Android. And if you want something that is curated with a beautiful interface and gorgeous design, but you do what they tell you to do, it's the iPhone. That's my summation.
You know, instead of applications for my phone, I want more applications for my mind. You know, I wish we could download or just buy on, you know, some sort of, you know, top-up basis, more for our just immediate software. The phone thing is just that one more.
But we have that, Chris. We have
that. How?
It's called a book. It's called a novel by writers such as yourself.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for years.
You think so?
Yeah,
that's,
I do.
Oh, that's very kind. That's I'd like to think that, you know, that, I'm part of that world that's doing that.
I pick up a cassette with the simplest interface of all. It's got words in a language I comprehend. And the words are very craftily put together. And they have better visuals than any piece of technology you can buy.
I mean the visuals they suggest?
The visuals of the prose.
Mm-hmm.
The visuals that occur in your brain when you are reading the story. George Lucas can't create that. James Cameron only wishes he could come close to the visuals provided by the written or spoken word. And I defy either Lucas or Cameron or their spokespeople to say that they have better visuals than the imagination.
I don't think they would.
I don't think they would either. I think they're champions of it.
That's how they got to what they were doing.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's because they understand that they've been able to do the best compromise possible. So a book is, to quote Isaac Asimov, or paraphrase him, is a cassette in which you can go forward and backward, where everything is always present, but you can change. Your mind, if you're reading aloud, Carol M. Schwiller mentioned this on her 90th birthday celebration, that you're actually reading ahead before your mouth gets there. Your mind is moving ahead and back at the same time, even though in a way your cursor, your imaginary cursor is on a given word, you're still moving back and forth at different moments at the same moment in a book. If you're playing with language, which is something that you very much do, and poetic stream of consciousness prose, you are approaching the mind in a manner that comes, it's not programming, it's suggestive programming. A program, a computer-run program, is the same for everybody. The written or spoken word it doesn't program you. It is a program that you employ.
And different for every person.
And absolutely different for every person.
Well, that is its power. That is definitely its power, that it can work simultaneously on both channels, mass stream and also intimate.
Yeah, And you, as a person who does more with your performance at a reading than just reading aloud, you often bring in live music with Eric
Wyatt,
and sometimes visual
props,
acts, whatever is appropriate for that given moment. It takes the written word and turns it into performance art.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the hope.
Well, I mean, that's what it is. I'm just stating what I've seen you do.
Mm. Well, I think that performance,
and now I'll add one word to that: excellent performance art. Now I'm praising. Before I was merely stating.
Well, thank you. It's
a perception.
It's certainly the way I relate to language and to story and how those connect to people, because you don't have language or a story or music until you have a listener, until you have a respondent. It's a two-channel thing, and it has to go two ways, otherwise it doesn't exist. And storytelling, even sentence uttering, you know, we forget that stories, you know, are made of sentences. Painters had to confront the fact that paintings were really organized color on a page. And writers, you know, have now had to accept that stories are actually made out of words. And I think some are surprised by that, as if they, you know, could have been made out of something else. But we're beginning to focus, I think, more on the words, just as words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the minutia that it breaks down to. But let's roll back. Let's talk a little bit about your writing, because even if we have captured people who've heard you on our air before, which seems unlikely because you were last here, as we said, about a year and a half ago at least, and in a different time slot at that point. And I'm not even convinced that a lot of people listening now were listening in that time slot. The people listening to that time slot hopefully are hearing Sydney Smith and R. Paul Martin for at least half of that. But tell us a little bit about your writing. How would you typify yourself?
The work that has just come out in the last couple of weeks is a book called Enigmatic Pilot, which is a follow-up and a prequel to my first novel, Zanesville, which are part of a story cycle that I call the Lodomania Testament. The publisher is Random House. This is sort of written actually back to front. The first book, Zanesville, is set in our near future. This book that's just come out takes us back into the past, to mid-19th century America and middle America, as in cities like St. Louis, where north, south, east, west, future, past, free, slave, poor, rich, black, white, any kind of dichotomy that was active in America seemed to be focused on that one city, right on, of course, on the major American river. So it's a mixture of what I'm doing, Jim, in terms of how I would describe myself. I've been likened to Thomas Pynchon. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I have mixed feelings about that. I very much admire him and also am puzzled. Michael Moorcock thinks that I'm a wonderful fellow, which is nice.
And I would say that people who like reading some of Moorcock's, you know, not the sword and sorcery Moorcock, but the science fiction, the yeah. Jerry Cornelius, Michael Moorcock, the Moorcock of New Worlds and all that, I think they would appreciate your work as well.
I think that's right. That's the side of Michael's audience that
also Brunner, also
yeah,
Brian Aldiss, a lot of the British New Wave,
J.G. Ballard.
Absolutely Ballard. One of my favorite writers, and all literary. At a time when writing literary works for science fiction wasn't popular.
there wasn't a model really before those guys, was there? I mean, really, they opened the envelope for that, I think.
They opened the envelope by... there were people who did it beforehand, but they didn't embrace the fact that it was science fiction. The earlier writers who did that kind of a thing, and they did that.
Is it John Wyndham who wrote Day of the Triffids and
That's
the Chrysalis? Yeah, he had a real style. Yeah.
And Edgar Pangborn is another one.
Yeah. Okay. I hear that.
Who got away with a lot of that stuff with Davy and A Mirror for Observers. Well, I can't think of a lot of women, unfortunately, but that's because that comes out of we're talking about an earlier era in which science fiction had not openly embraced women. And the few women who were writing in those days were writing with, two initials, like, you know, C.M. Moore, and so forth.
How would you classify Ursula K. Le Guin?
U.K. Le Guin, as she was published in Playboy magazine, comes later. She's almost next generation. Not to J.G. Ballard, but she's a groundbreaker, as is Joanna Russ, as is Carol M. Schwiller. But they're almost a little bit later than Brunner, Moorcock. Moorcock is working well into the 50s. M. Schwiller, she was writing in the 50s. Her first sale was in 1954. But she wasn't writing with a full steam, really, until the Dangerous Visions era of the later 60s. And her main output has been since 1990, when her husband Ed died. So they're as important and they're as groundbreaking and all that. And they have high literary values. But they weren't in that particular wave, I think, of Moorcock, Ballard. I guess they're concurrent to Brunner. I guess they're concurrent to Aldous.
Well, there's a stream that goes through all of them, sort of however it's sort of organized in time, because there's certainly something that links all those. It's a particular sort of vision of fiction and science fiction. I mean, I think Ballard said, you know, his point of view was that all fiction is in the future will be science fiction because you can't get around it. So he really sought to erase that barrier completely. And I think that was an interesting, really bold statement. And when you look at the British writers did a lot of that, of really rejecting the whole literary, you know, if it was postmodernism or whatever, the blend into science fiction, into genre fiction. They totally rejected that. And yet it's still, you know, a debate, you know, going on now. It's sort of, I think it's beginning to lose interest and steam, don't you?
I'm sorry, run that actually by me again.
Don't you think that the whole the struggle between literary fiction
and
science fiction as it's defined...
Oh, it's steam. I'm sorry. I was thinking somehow I got drifting off into steampunk thinking.
No,
which is a whole other story.
That argument is, and that concern is beginning just to kind of wilt and fade away.
I'm hoping it does. I'm hoping that it will. But it's a tough one because, in a way, science fiction has flourished in the ghetto that it built for itself. And if it wasn't for that ghetto, if it wasn't for that you are stuck in this genre and you must write for it, I don't think Philip K. Dick would have written what he wrote. I think, you know, he would have written more books like...
Humpty Dumpty in Oakland?
Yes. Humpty Dumpty in Oakland, Confessions of a Crap Artist, which is a lot of fun.
I like both those books.
No, they're fine. They're fine. But you, in that case, you wouldn't have Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep or Yubik or Valis or...
Yeah.
Or all of the... Well, the good side is you wouldn't have all of those movies, but The Adjustment Bureau. Well, I haven't seen The Adjustment Bureau. I shouldn't put it down.
I'm still recovering from the Tom Cruise one.
Now, you see, that I didn't think was horrible. Of course, that isn't... Dick didn't really write that.
No.
That's just L.A.
But
Confidential.
Tom Cruise was in it. That's all that matters.
It was a Spielberg film. It wasn't that bad. But it also wasn't Phil Dick. It was his universe, but not his story. And that story isn't a very good story, by the way. Anybody who's read The Minority Report.
Do you know, he wrote a letter to the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle on the day I was born.
Did he now?
Yeah. My grandmother saved the whole paper, and I went through it, and I couldn't believe it. He signed it from Berkeley. He wasn't that well known yet, but he was starting to get it happening. And what he wrote about, there was a repeated thing of criticism about, like, neo-beatnik people ruining San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a letter in, you know, saying, you know, in response and in support of this movement. And he said, you know, he said it back in 18th century England and recited off all these famous writers. You know, these people are just hanging out at the cafe. They do nothing. They should be, you know, sent to the army or made to, you know, do honest work like felling trees. And the irony of that was just so beautiful. It was a really well-crafted little letter to the editor. And later, I followed that story when I went back to the library to check on this, you know, what was the aftermath of that day. Because I only had the one original hard copy. And, you know, that little note from Philip K. Dick spawned all these responses. Because people just, either didn't know how to take him, or they thought he was great. And when you think about it, that's the reaction he got, isn't
man.
It?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
people either went whoa or just thought yeah.
But all I'm saying is that the ghetto of science fiction was a very good thing for Philip K. Dick, and
I agree.
And the fact that a literary figure like Michael Chabon will embrace science fiction and say yes. Science fiction is what I write. It's part of, you know, it's something I employ in a lot of my writing, and I'm proud of it, is a great thing. I won't get into the Ursula Le Guin versus Margaret Atwood argument, which I would say is specious, although wonderful to watch.
Sounds like a cage fight.
Well, yeah, it is, sort of, if you've been following it. You know, Margaret Atwood, who sets novels in the future on Earths that with aliens and having... catastrophes that have not occurred and things like that, says that she and wrote some of the best science fiction books ever, like The Handmaid's Tale, denies that she's ever written a word of science fiction.
Yes, that was a strange denunciation, wasn't it?
It is a very strange one, and now Le Guin has, they've become a traveling roadshow in letters, pages, and also in lectures and speeches that each of them give, these two wonderful women of letters debating this issue, which is worth 10 shows, but not this morning's show. But then you have the other side of it. You have people like Kelly Link, who simply breathe both literature and speculative fiction at the same time, in the same breath, and are writing this thing that is clearly of the genre and is clearly of literature. And if you are a literary person and you read her stuff, it might pull you into science fiction. And if you're simply a science fiction reader, reading Kelly Link might bring you to, you know, greater works of literary fiction.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So in a way, I would say the genre serves well. It helps focus people.
Well, it's a brand that people can understand. It's a category that opens up channels of thought.
Yeah.
And they know where they're at. And then they can get, you know, it's like the theme park you want to get lost in, but you want to know sort of where you are at the start.
Which is why Harry Potter is so popular, because when Rowling created Harry Potter, it was familiar, even though it was sort of new. But, you know, Wizards in Schools, well, Le Guin had done that, you know, 15 years earlier.
It seemed very familiar to me.
It was very familiar. The stories were plotted very British, very Agatha Christie, using it was a synthesis of formulas that never, including, of course, the juvenile, with one major innovation, which was the idea that the characters grew in more or less real time, as the readers did.
Which is a little bit verging on the obligatory now, I think, in today's terms.
But I mean, Rowling created that. She innovated that, let me, and coined it.
Haven't we had TV characters that have done that? Cartoon characters?
Not over that number of years and not with that kind of popularity. No, cartoon characters really don't age.
Most of them don't, but... I can't think of any.
Daffy Duck today, if Daffy Duck were to exist, because all the Warner Card.
Well, the Flintstones. Look, hang on. There was, you know, a day when there wasn't, you know.
Pebbles, yeah, they added a baby.
Two babies, Pebbles and Bam Bam.
They added babies. Yeah. But outside of that, they were just the Honeymooners.
Yeah, but there was a little. But the kids grew up, though.
In separate shows. I believe it wasn't in the Flintstones that they grew up. They had their own shows. They spun off their own shows.
Yeah, but, well, see, they spun off their own shows because they started in the Flintstones.
Yeah, but it didn't have the writing. It didn't have the animation. It didn't have what the Flintstones had. It was totally different people.
Hanna-Barbera?
No. If it was Hanna-Barbera, it wasn't those two people who made those shows. They were well out of the business by that time.
Well, maybe, but their daughters the same studio.
That's not the same thing. J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter. She wrote every word of every Harry Potter book and watched over. One person wrote every movie. Steve Clovis has written every movie.
Well, then two people to catch and prosecute, then that's
well, you can say that, but the point is, this is the innovation. Mm. I'll take issue here. I can't think of anything else that has ever let their characters grow and reach a finale. Mm. Harry Potter's middle-aged parent at the end of the last book and will be in the end of the movie coming out this July. That finishes it. He starts out 10 years old or 11 years old and takes us through him being about 20 years old and then jumps ahead into the future and it's done. And it happened real time. An 11-year-old reading that book, reading the first book, would be 20 years old when they read the last book. And they grew up with Harry. They grew at the same rate. And that's very different. Pebbles and Bam Bam just appeared on the scene and then one day became teenagers. There was no real-time aspect to it at all.
No. Wonderfully, no. It just happened, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah. They were, you know, like Minerva. They just came forth fully grown.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying about Harry Potter. I mean, it's... I guess that's interesting about the real time aspect.
It's a very important. It's a. I think it's a very important key to its popularity, and to how it captured a zeitgeist and helped create because it's such a marketing genius. And when you talk about a place you can walk around, you can go to Harry Pottersville or whatever they call it down in Florida, and it's a huge success. This is an industry, a major multi-billion-dollar industry, and I think the idea that people grew up with it real time, I think the young people today, the 11-year-olds today, who are reading the first Harry Potter book now and will finish the Deathly Hallows book in next year, are going to have a completely different experience than the ones who waited online at midnight for the next book to come out.
I don't doubt that. I just wonder how enduring the thing's going to be. Sometimes the things that the waves that hit the biggest don't really extend the farthest, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But eventually Tolkien made it after, you know, he was a cult sensation in his lifetime and now is a worldwide phenomenon. C.S. Lewis is only, you know, in the last 5 years, hitting major modern media, biographies of him notwithstanding. And that's for better or worse. I was a fan of C.S. Lewis as a kid, and not when I started realizing all the religious material in it as I grew up. So that lost some of its luster for me. But Harry Potter is a phenomenon that's not going away for 50 years. Easily. The movies alone. If there's a Turner Classic Movies today watching silent film, there are people who are going to be watching Harry Potter in 50 years, if not reading it.
Well, only time will tell, I guess. That's I think there's, you know, an obvious...
And we have young icons to go with, Daniel Radcliffe being on Broadway right now and getting very good reviews on Broadway.
Oh, you got all the properties, there's no question.
But no, it's not just the property. It's the point is that, you know, in 50 years when Daniel Radcliffe is 70, he may still be acting, and therefore the franchise will still be alive. Not as Harry Potter, but people remember, hey, remember that old guy? He used to play Harry Potter. And a few of us remember Daniel Radcliffe as an actor before Harry Potter. He was in the Tailor of Panama, John le Carré.
Never heard of it.
Oh, it's a wonderful movie. Wonderful movie starring Jeffrey Rush and Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Radcliffe, written by John le Carré. I highly recommend it. It's John le Carré's answer to Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana.
All right. Okay. That's a great book.
That's a great book. And the two books together are sort of a wonderful call and response. And the two movies in that movie with Alec Guinness and Noel Coward is an Ernie Kovacs. Burl Ives. That's a wonderful movie. And as is The Tailor of Panama with Jeffrey Rush and Daniel Radcliffe and Pierce Brosnan. I mean, Radcliffe obviously has a small role. He was 9. But
Jeffrey Rush is a great actor. He's Australian. He's really... You see him around... I live in Melbourne, and you actually... Where he does, too. And you see him from time to time. And he's just... He's got one of those amazing faces that's just...
Yeah, it's so thoroughly expressive. It's why when they show the King's Speech, they show his face.
It's amazing.
You know, along with Colin Firth, because you have to show Colin Firth, but the focus is on Jeffrey Rush.
Yeah, and for someone who has also a very powerful and very just measured voice, he's got the facial thing even more so. He's great to see. I saw him on stage in Melbourne, and
I think he just finished a stage run or is still on stage right now in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
At the Brooklyn Academy of Music in Diary of a Madman.
He really gets around on stage as well as you know, in front of the cameras, which is pretty impressive given the number of films that he's involved with each year. But geez, he's so good on stage, that projection personality, that just that energy, no matter how small, you know. I think that's one of the things as a writer I really have tried to learn from actors is that it really is those little details that make it, that attention to detail where someone else would just go, no, it's not important. Just being willing to believe that, yeah, it might be very important to the whole thing. Just nail it.
I have not yet read Enigmatic Pilot. I am a huge fan of Zanesville, and of course I really enjoyed Private Midnight. But first question is, who published Enigmatic Pilot?
The Ballantine and Del Rey imprint of Random House.
Oh, well, la-di-da. Okay. Zanesville was...
Villard Books, another right. imprint of Random House.
So. Oh, is it? Okay. Okay. But not as... Well, I guess it's widely distributed. Once it's Random House, that's all over. I mean, not by all over, I mean distributed everywhere.
Yes.
I don't mean you're done for.
Yes, interesting slip there. Now, no, what you meant to say is correct. That's the idea, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and which very much fits into the whole theme, actually, of the Zanesville. The series. You have an overall name for the series.
Yeah, the Lodomania Testament.
Right, which you had when the first book came out.
Right, And there is a definite umbrella to, I call it, rather than a series, it's a cycle. So there is a definite overall shape to it, which will emerge with this book that now, and then the next one. I think it'll become sort of clear where we're going. We're not lost as the series, you know.
Yeah, and it has the underpinning of connectivity. Well, so many things being connected.
I hope so. That's the way I see it. You know, I see this beautiful, intricate, connected, vibrant, sort of undulating shape that is the whole story. And I just want to be able to capture that finally when it's delivered across the whole cycle for the reader. If I could just get a little bit of that sense, that would just be fantastic.
Yeah. Now, would you like to read a little at this point?
Sure, sure.
You said you had about a 10 or 15 minute selection?
Yeah, it's... I thought I might sort of go into the story a little bit. I'll give a little bit of background, but I think I'm hoping that the chapter will kind of explain itself. The hero of this story, and there is a hero, is a young boy named Lloyd Meadhorn Saturd, who, if you have read Zanesville, you will see a connection. If you haven't, he's a super prodigy, born in Ohio in 1838, and just far beyond other children. His parents are of mixed blood, so he is too, and they are hounded out of their town of Zanesville, Ohio, for reasons of debt, and sent on the road down to Texas, where they hope to claim some land that they've inherited. But along the way, they get stuck in St. Louis, 1844 now, and that was the main nerve in America at that point in time. The boundary between the North and the South, the East and the West, bordering the Mississippi River, the hub of finance for that part of America, the dividing point between wagon trains going north on the Oregon Trail or south on the Santa Fe Trail. This is where Lloyd and his family fall apart in St. Louis, with so many attractions and distractions, temptations, and people out to get them. Lloyd is taken in by a humped-back antiquarian bookseller who allows him to study at his humble and dust-filled shop. In doing so, he realizes Lloyd's hyperactive mind and prodigious intellect, and he decides that he will introduce Lloyd to a very special patron. But Lloyd has to meet the bookseller at the old ferry landing at the appointed time of midnight. A full moon reflected off the wharf and the chimneys of the docked boats, giving the Mississippi a sickly silver sheen. Shelling, the bookseller, was waiting for him. Two stevedore-muscled black men were on board a cramped, decrepit steam launch, one at the helm, one standing guard. Despite the warm summer night, the boy shivered. Stoked with cottonwood and cypress, the boiler of the dilapidated boat powered the craft out into the current. The telltale silhouette of a yawl rode off south beyond them, and a beaming coal barge loomed out toward the Illinois side. Beyond that, no one appeared to be on the water except for them and the moonlight. Shelling handed Lloyd a strip of dark muslin. "Please blindfold yourself," he said. "Why?" Lloyd asked, the hair rising on the back of his neck. "You will see," Shelling replied. "Trust me." Lloyd flopped down on a crate and wrapped the cloth around his head as he was instructed. This was not at all what he'd expected, but the familiar sounds of the boat surging through the river filled him with a confused sense of resignation and anticipation. Surely this man meant him well. He listened hard, trying to picture their progress away from St. Louis. The hiss of the gauge cock, the low rumble of the mud valves. At first he was sure they were headed upriver, and then they turned, and perhaps again. Twice, shelling raised him up and spun him around, as if to further disorient him. Not a word was spoken between the humpback and his dark-skinned crew. On and on the boat plowed, then drifted. At last it became clear that they were docking. There were the sounds of pulling into a wharf, the change in the rhythm of the machinery, backwash, scrambling of hands and legs, ropes heaved. Lloyd was lifted onto some sort of pier, forcibly by one of the Negroes, he surmised, and pushed gently but forcibly into a seated position. After several minutes, he heard the clip-clop of a horse's hooves and the clump of a wagon. He was hoisted again in one graceful maneuver and set down in what he felt seemed like a dog cart. He could tell that Shelling was beside him by the scent of the witch hazel. Reins jingled. The cart rattled off on a rutted, hard-packed road. They rode for perhaps 20 minutes. When the blindfold at last came off and Lloyd's eyes had gotten used to seeing again, he saw that they had come to a dismal clearing back off from the river set on a cliff. A forbidding wall of pines ringed the lumpy open ground, which was studded with shapes that brought to mind his Chapel Cove back in Zanesville. "What is this place?" he asked. "A slave cemetery," Shelling answered. "At least it appears to be." He stepped down out of the dog cart and helped the boy to the ground. With his eyes growing more alert, Lloyd saw the moonlight rain down across a field of primitive graves, rock markers, splintered wooden crosses, and iron bars. The eerie call of a screech owl echoed through the trees. "Why are we here?" the boy asked, feeling a ghostly presence rising like mist from the stumps and stones. The bookseller did not respond, but instead looked around. Looked around again, listening hard. Then he lit a lucifer match and held it above his head. In the still, soft air, it glowed white gold for a few seconds before he shook it out. A moment later, a flicker of light answered back from the cliffside, and a whippoorwill called from the tangle of rosemary to the west. "All right," Shelling decided, and directed the boy toward a grave marked by a slab of granite that in the glare of the moon Lloyd saw had gouged into its surface the words, "Nothing." With unexpected agility and strength, Shelling bent down and heaved the slab to one side, revealing a sturdy wooden ladder descending into the blackness beneath the burial ground. Lloyd was alarmed at this discovery, but intrigued. "Wait a moment," Shelling commanded, and disappeared down the ladder. Lloyd heard another match crack and saw a faint flare from below. There was the chunk of a chain, and then a lock clicking and a door being pried open. Shelling's head reappeared out of the ground. "Come," he whispered. Pale light streamed to meet them now, and Lloyd followed the man down 10 rungs into what he took to be a crypt, but which smelled like some kind of root cellar. As soon as he stepped off the ladder and had his feet firmly planted, he saw that the cellar opened up into what looked like a gallery of natural catacombs, only the first of which was lit by a lantern. The air was cool, but surprisingly dry. As his eyes became adjusted to the shadows, Lloyd saw that the chambers stretching into the distance were filled with paintings and statues, row upon row of shelves lined with leather-bound books, stuffed animals, skeletons, weapons, scientific instruments, and unidentified machines. High ground, Shelley announced. Part of a cave system that the river can't reach. It has been used for many purposes in the past, but now it serves as our hiding place. Who are you hiding from, and what is all this? Lloyd asked. It is but a Main Street museum of anatomy compared to what it once was, Shelley answered somberly. Where did all these things come from? Europe, Egypt, Syria, Palestine, Mesopotamia, Massachusetts, all over the world. Are they yours? The boy asked. I am the custodian and cataloger, but the collection belongs to the Sporosians. Mother Tongue will explain to you. Are you ready to meet her? I guess so, Lloyd answered. Up to now, he had supposed that this supposed patron, Mother Tongue, might be some senile member of some illumination society. But what if she was something else? Shelley lit a hurricane lantern and steered him past a Chippendale cabinet on which perched a dented conquistador's helmet. A curve in the rock wall brought them to a flight of steps hacked down into the claystone. The humped man motioned for the boy to follow. The stairs led down to a landing that was flooded with the light from a golden candelabrum that took the shape of a tall, full tree. On each branch burned a thick green candle, and between the spitting and dripping of the wax, Lloyd heard the gentle lap of water below. Outside the aura of the tapers, the cave ceiling opened up like a tunnel that had been blasted to make way for a train, and then narrowed to a tight stricture on the other side of a large obsidian dark pool. Floating in the water before him was a small, ornate steamboat, stained with moss and algae. All its windows were dark except one. A black man dressed as a coach whip stood beside a gangplank that led from the landing to the riverboat, holding an oil lamp. Mother Tongue is expecting you, Shelley told him. Blazon will be your escort. I will wait for you here. Lloyd was gripped with such a blend of apprehension and excitement that he could barely move, but move he did into the black man's lamplight and over the gangplank, half thinking that the weird boat would evaporate the moment he stepped foot on board. It did not, but it looked as if it might well sink or had sunk and had been raised from the depths of the river. In the stillness of the cave, Lloyd imagined that he could hear the very nails aching in the swollen planks. The man, Blazon, remained stone silent, but led him straight to the central parlor on the main deck, where the one lamp shone. Then, just as he was opening the weather-beaten wooden door, the most miraculous thing Lloyd had ever seen in his life happened. Everything around him burst alight, so suddenly that he thought the boat was in flames. He let out a giant gasp which seemed to please Blazon. The boat was not on fire, but shimmering with tiny prisms that looked as if they were made of isinglass and filled with lightning. But what means the prisms came to life, Lloyd could only guess. As instantly as they ignited, they expired, and he found himself blinking hard. He heard Blazon close the door behind him, then his own heartbeat. A single glass oil lamp with extended wick stood on a walnut table beside an old cane plantation chair and a ladderback rocker made of pine. Seated in the cane monstrosity was the oldest woman Lloyd had ever seen. Her hair was pure white and thick. Her face, which was the color of blancmange, was fantastically wrinkled, and yet she sat upright without a hint of palsy, dressed in a cool-looking long white dress, like a southern lady about to serve tea. The only other piece of furniture in the room was a weary haircloth sofa on which a mangy coonhound was fast asleep. Come, the old woman called to him, indicating the ladder back. The lights, Lloyd tried, but he couldn't complete his question. He found himself meandering toward the rocking chair as if in a trance, and once seated was startled when one of the runners pressed down on the tail of a cat, but not like any cat he'd ever encountered. It was hairless, sleek of body. Its skin was rose pink, becoming the color of pencil lead on its paws. With a face that reminded Lloyd of a mask, and remarkable slitted eyes that were as green as his own. Curiosity, the old woman commanded, and the cat leapt into her lap. You're always putting yourself in harm's way. Lloyd tried to ease himself back into the chair, glad the hound hadn't stirred. When he managed to settle, he was again shaken by the old woman's eyes. He had noticed from across the room that she wore no spectacles, which had surprised him given her obvious age. But he was surprised still further to find her now looking straight at him, with eyes as green as the cat's and his too, as green as absence, but clear. The room was silent, but for the purring of the feline and what he imagined to be the trip hammer of his heart. He wanted to know about the lights, what he was doing there. He tried to remain still. The old coonhound slept on. At first the woman's green eyes stabbed at him like darning needles, but gradually the intensity of her scrutiny eased. There was no decaying odor of ravaged flesh or incontinence about her, as he had experienced with the older Zanesville biddies. No, rather there was a clean, simple scent of lemon verbena. Despite the alien surroundings and the circumstances that had brought him there, he began to feel reassured until the ancient lady spoke. You've already been with a woman, haven't you? A grown woman. How did you know that? Lloyd cried. Can you read minds? No, but I've heard that you can, the woman answered, and her face assumed an inscrutable smile. Can you guess how old I am? 80, Lloyd tried, afraid that he might offend her. Fiddlesticks, she laughed. 100, then. Oh, I'm every bit of that, she sighed. Every bit, and then some. I think you're the oldest person I've ever seen, Lloyd admitted. The old coon dog dozed on. I am, Lloyd, and I don't know how much longer I have. So let me cut off the gristle and get to the meat. There's nothing wrong with your discovery of your manhood, even if you are still a child. The first experience of the flesh is a great challenge for everyone, but it is a special trial for males, and you have passed yours. That may bode well. You are destined to run well before yourself in many ways. Now, before I tell you the things you were brought here to hear, I will let you ask me one question. What would you like to know about? The lights? Lloyd pondered for a moment, feeling for the woman's intent. I think you'll tell me about the lights, he replied at last. What I'd like to know is how you get this boat through such a narrow passage. The woman gave the cat a long, deep stroke. The boat never leaves this grotto. Nor do I. It wouldn't be safe for me to move about any more. She clutched the hairless cat tighter and lowered her voice. And I don't mean to frighten you, Lloyd, but there may come a time, sooner than you think, when it won't be safe for you to move about so freely either. Lloyd shifted in his chair, unable to turn his gaze from the woman's eyes, which reached out and embraced him, her words filling the sparsely furnished room like the shadows that closed in around the lamp.
Nice.
Thank you.
Very nice. Thank you. You are listening, by the way, to WBAI in New York City and WBAI.org, or 99.5 FM in New York. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, more to the point, and you just heard reading from his new novel, Enigmatic Pilot, Chris Sacknussemm. And is it fair to say you'd probably get more out of it if you read Zanesville first and then then moved on?
Look, there is a view that that's true. One review just came out that pointed that out. I've heard both sides. I think that the one sort of reinvents the other in a sense, and I'm hoping that as the whole thing rolls out, there will not be that sense of which came first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of configuration that's ultimately
building. Well, yeah, you've definitely got that whole surreal thing down. But again, this actually sort of goes back to what we were talking about with rolling, in terms of all that I can do is wait for the next book.
Right.
And then I'm following it in a particular progression. It's going to be very interesting to see how a 20-year-old in 20 years takes the whole cycle, and how, if they have read it, you know, in a more Dada-esque fashion, or, you know, taking whatever out of the hat and reading it, which can be done. With the individual parts, right?
Well, I think so. I think the reality is some people will do that, and I think there's already a sense that that it does work on an individual book basis. But getting the whole cycle is still the deal, and I think that however that's delivered, whether it be, you know, that linear straight progression or something a little bit more diagonal and dimensional, that
a little more cross time, as it were.
Yeah. And there's where I think you what you're doing is not breaking up the cycle, but you're giving people different avenues of access to it.
Yeah, that makes,
you're running more trains, really. So people, you know, that's really what it amounts to. There's more ways for people to get on board.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, I don't want to stretch that metaphor too far. What station they get on board at? The only station we'll deal with right now is that it's WBAI.
Touché.
And if, by the way, if you would like to call up WBAI and speak with Chris about his work, feel free to do so. The telephone number here is area code 212-209-2900. We have about 15 minutes left before we bid adieu, and Lister comes in with Burn Baby Burn clappers. Give us a ring and share. And of course, there is but one primary rule. Be on topic. If you're not on topic, you'll be off the air. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio.
Good morning. This is Winston from Brooklyn.
Hello.
I was really intrigued by that story just now. I caught it halfway when I turned on, and it was really interesting. Where could I get the book to buy?
Well, thank you very much. I'm very grateful to hear that. Where, if you're in the New York area?
I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Well, there's bookstores all over Brooklyn. Any bookstore, and for that matter, most libraries in the Brooklyn Public Library will have it.
And it's on Amazon. Amazon is, you know, a fast bet. But, yeah, just Google on it.
Yeah, it's called Enigmatic Pilot. The author is Chris Sacknussemm, which is Sacknussemm, and it's in all major vendors of bookstores carry Ballantine books.
Thank you. I'm sorry that you had to cut it off right there, because it was getting more interesting, you know, very interesting.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay, have a good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
A couple of things. I have to mention that I think Harry Potter is a complete ripoff of the Earthsea trilogy.
Well, I would kind of. I won't argue. I'm sorry.
Speaking of Doctor Who, he's very Radcliffe-like, the new Doctor Who.
Yes.
And I don't think he's as good as Tennant, which was actually brilliant, especially compared to Erickson and this guy.
Well, you know what?
It's not about.
Okay, I don't want to talk too much about Doctor Who this show, but I will say it's not about the Doctor; it's about the writer.
I like Moffat. I like Moffat, and Moffat. I would also recommend the new Doctor Who New Adventure book forms, which are also very good, and some are written by Terrence Dix and all that stuff.
Right,
very good. But I'd have to criticize this guy that I just heard read.
Well, you're talking to him.
I know.
Well, then, just imagine that you're in a living room. Don't talk to somebody as if they're not in the room. Talk to Chris.
Okay. I just didn't like, the one thing I heard was like, you've come here to hear. I mean, in my writing, I get to that problem where it seems like you're repeating the same word in the same phrase or even couple of words, and you have to find sort of symmetry for another word. I mean, that in itself didn't seem like it was very good. And it all seems like, you know, especially on this show, like you have a lot of readers that are reading their own work that aren't, I guess I have a more theatrical kind of want for this type of stuff, and it seems like it's just so...
Well, these are books, not necessarily radio, and this is a reading.
Yeah, but here, I mean, I was listening to it and going like, that's not very good. Anyway, I'll go now.
Yeah, you do
I just don't like the new Doctor Who. Better get better. I hope it's...
Well, you know what? I disagree with you on all counts. I'm sorry.
Well, I have my own opinion.
That's what makes the world spin.
Yeah.
Take
Sorry,
care.
Everybody, but that's it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Wow.
Well, here, there. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Mr. Sack Newsome, I am so taken with your setting for this book.
Oh, thank you.
I taught Trans-Mississippi Western History for 30 years, and so I'm very fascinated by where you've set this. As you were reading, I could hear banjos playing in the background, and I was waiting for someone to call out Mark Twain.
Thank you. That's what was kind of the goal. Certainly to call attention to that amazing period.
I would love to talk to you. I'm assuming you have done a lot of historical research into the period. You mentioned 1838. 1838. Without giving things away, does the book actually take place basically in 1844, or do we move up to the antebellum start of the Civil War?
More the former. There is a hint, a foreshadowing of a later period, but essentially, no, it's all 1838 to 1845.
And it basically takes place in and around St. Louis and on points west?
Correct.
Oh, my.
Yes. With a slight Australian accent, but,
yes, I was
but Chris is born here.
Yeah. Oh,
Chris is American.
Yeah. Oh, but you live in Australia, right?
I do now, yes.
Have you ever, just a quick question, have you ever set any of your works in Australia?
I have a work in progress, that is, yes.
Devoted to perhaps Australian folklore, traditions, and other related materials?
Not so much, really. It's a little bit more of a contemporary story than that.
Because Australia and the United States, you know, have a very, very similar background historically in terms of migrations west. An Aussie friend of mine once said to me, there isn't a self-respecting Aussie who doesn't have a convict in his background somewhere. I'm either a convict or a bushranger. But I really am looking forward to reading Enigmatic Pilot. This sounds like, if I didn't know who you were, and if this weren't a science fiction show, I would immediately take this as a sweeping frontier epic.
Well,
of the highest.
Well, tradition. Don't think that it isn't.
I mean, of the highest tradition. I mean, this sounds to me like a Donald Goldsmith or what of some of.
I mean, the moment that you start classifying it as one thing and not another.
No, Jim, I'm not classifying it. I mean,
I'm just saying, you know, you would think that it was this, and the answer is, well, why isn't it that? Of course, it's that.
Well, I mean, listen. I mean, it obviously sounds like a wonderful history of the American mid-frontier 19th century with obviously some very, very interesting non, how would I put it, I don't want to say spectral, but supernatural overtones.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. That's a fair description of what you what I've just put forward in that one chapter. I think that's
I could see this as a multidimensional program musically. What you would need for this would be an old timey group with a fiddle, a banjo, and perhaps a hammer dulcimer in the background, doing 19th century tunes.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that's overflowed into another project of mine, which is very much on that line.
Really?
Is that the next one that you were talking about, the third?
No, this is unrelated. It's a book coming out in February called Reverend America. But it has very much a music soundtrack behind it.
Really?
And connected with it.
With a folky theme, I hope.
Well, it's a mixture of folky, blues, gospel, roots, jazz, and sort of clunky outsider weird music like Harry Parks sort of stuff, you know.
Well, I tell you, tomorrow I'm going to go to some bookstore and get this, because this sounds like something worth the read, and I can, you know, good luck to you and continued success.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good morning. We have 6 minutes left. The number is 212-209-2900. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Victoria, Victoria. Lovely story. I just love it.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
You might want to turn down your radio.
Yeah. It has all the elements that are pleasing in the Harry Potter story. But the benefit of...
I shouldn't have brought that up.
No. All of those, I mean, the things, plus it has the element of the wildness of the frontier, not sort of just glimpsed over in the horizon, yet beyond it, who knows what, dragons lie. And it has the element of the magical, and yet, by the nature of being it set in the Mississippi, of the... No, more or less the Mark Twain era, the practical where a young boy had to be hard and strong and so on to survive. It's got all the classics of an archetype, and yet I'm sure that you've added wonderful things of your own, and will give us the details that make it sort of yummy about to what they wore and what kind of music and what kind of food and music and so on.
I think calling it archetype synthesis might be an interesting...
I think that's an excellent idea. I think that I've read, again, I only woke up and a while ago. I missed your guest's last name.
My guest last night? I wasn't on last night.
No, last name, your guest.
Oh, I'm sorry, Saknussemm. we're going to have to spell it for everybody.
Yeah, you ought to be sorry, Jim.
Yes, Saknussemm.
Now, there you go.
And we'll do it again at the end of the show.
You're dashing off, and I didn't have time to reach down. You know, we don't all sit here with a pencil in our hand and a pad in our lap.
Okay, well, it will be repeated at the end of the show, so everybody can find the books and the website and everything.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that I'm sitting in my room and looking out at I think it's not quite a neat moon, but there's not...
I saw it on the way in. It is interesting-looking
moon. Just a pleasure in my room. I can see it. Well, that's just...
But speaking of dashing off, I'm off in just a couple of minutes.
Right, okay, so I'll let you get on with your business and... on. Will you be at the book fair any of the, on Saturday or Sunday?
Nope.
Oh, I do look forward to meeting you. When do you go to the, KGB?
The third Wednesday of every month, although I missed this last one. And, of course, I run the other reading series.
Okay.
New York, that's the first Tuesday of every month.
Okay, so third Wednesday of every month.
Well, that's KGB, but come to my reading series, why don't you?
Terrific, but you see, I still don't have a computer, and, we talked about this.
Okay, that's irrelevant. It's the first Tuesday of every month, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art.
Who knows?
But I'm getting off the air now.
Right, go.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you. Okay. Hi, Lester. The next, but having said that, the next NYRSIF reading, by the way, will be a tribute to Theodore Sturgeon with Ted Sturgeon's family there. So I do hope that people will show up for that. And blah, blah. And my guest next week on this show, by the way, is Genevieve Valentine, who's been on this show a number of times. But her first novel is just coming out. So that's that will be a small celebration.
Cool.
So what we should do, actually, is just guide people towards where they can find all the things that they want to involve themselves with your work, which, by the way, we need to point out includes sculpture and all kinds of arts.
That's true. There's a book called The Colors of Compulsion, which is a portfolio book of my paintings and masks. No, I think just Google on Saknussemm, Chris Saknussemm.
And that's Chris with a K.
K-R-I-S-S.
Sorry, one S, though.
S-A-K-N-U-S-S-E-M-M, and I think you'll find your way into the magical realm.
Yeah, that should more or less do it. And personally, I would say not to put buy all the books now, but start reading Zanesville. It's, I think, a wonderful intro, or for that matter, some of the short stories in, what's the name of the collection?
Sinister Miniatures. Yeah.
Sinister Miniatures. Yeah. Oh, and you have a copy right there.
I've got a copy for you, John.
Oh, well, thank you. Ooh. And oh, my God. Is this your cover?
It's not my illustration. Oh, okay. It's a fabulous cover, I think.
It is a fabulous cover. Everybody, I hope, can see it. I'm holding it up to the microphone.
It's worth looking at.
It really is just wonderful, surrealistic, fab, as it all should be. Lazy Fascist is the publisher here?
Yes, in Portland.
Oh, my God. Oh, my.
A tremendous indie press.
What a great name.
Yeah.
I love that. So, ooh, we have 30 seconds left. So, the time has gone ever so quickly. One more time for those who didn't guess it. Get it. S-A-K-N-U-S-S-E-M-M. Okay. Chris Saknussemm. When are you coming to the States back, and are you doing any more appearances while you're here?
Yeah, I am going to do a couple more. They're sort of more musically related, uptown, which will be fun. But I'm going to come back again very soon because the promotion for Reverend America will start before Christmas.
Okay. So we will see you here then.
Yes, you will.
And possibly another reading. We'll have to work that out.
I hope so.
All righty. So again, thank Chris for being here. Thank you all for listening. If you have a copy of last week's show, I don't. I have the radio drama. I don't have the ensuing discussion because the WBAI archive basically up. And I am unhappy about that. So if you are a person who can help provide same, I would really appreciate it. Last week, midnight to 3. So stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Listers already here setting up all the CDs for your listening wonderment. And I'll be back next week, Wednesday night, Thursday morning, from 1:30 to 3 a.m. We go out, as always, with Steel Eye Span. See you after this wonderful new Doctor Who has premiered. Take care. Good morning. Here.
system!
Burn it!
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
Baby, burn!
tell you this. Long before there was a staple singer, there was a liquidator. Long before there was a liquidator, there was the Alton Ellis. List Alive 99.5. No reggae show gonna tell you that.
Girl, I've got a date. Ah, an atmosphere I can say lay.
List Alive, you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York.
We're gonna rock your steady right about now. This one was done in 1966. Reggae, early years of the reggae music, and it says something like this. Oh. It said, you better get ready. I come to rock steady. Your body light, shake your shoulders, everything in time, then sing. Oh, 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 oh. If you feel like rock steady, rock steady, you better get your reggae. Let's do rock steady, yeah. Your body line, shake your shoulders, everything is time, and sing. Oh, 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 oh. If you feel like
yeah,
rock steady, rock steady. Wait, 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 wait.
People, get it ready, cause I'm coming on strong.
Let's do rock steady.
now that you know. Shake your head, rock your body like, shake your shoulders, everything in time, then sing. Oh, 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 oh.
People, get it ready, because I'm all on the drum.
It's a rock. In the evening, it's a rock. When you feel like you're a rock, now you're ready. Let's do rock steady. Yeah. You've got to do this new dance now that you're ready. You've got to do it just like Uncle Freddy. Now that you know. Shake your head, rock your body like, shake your shoulders, everything in time, and sing. Oh, 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 oh. If you feel like the rock steady,
this is the late, great icon, Alton Ellis, right here at 99.5, List Alive. 12 minutes after 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, we'll burn the American flag to ashes with no apologies. Straight up, Baba Bacon style. 212-209-2900, so we do it. Who's got the weed? Who's got the fire? Who's got the sense of mania?